Please welcome Ryan Turner.
All right. Good morning, everyone. How are you? All right. Excellent. I'll be nursing my cup of coffee this morning. How many of you have had your caffeine, your nicotine? Everyone's getting their morning stimulants. Good, good, good. Does the body good. I'm happy to be here. You know, it is the end of the year, and so I have to tell you, as we travel the fruited plains, it's nice to see who's here and always wondering what happened to so and so. So anyway, I'm here to talk to you about something a little bit different this morning. You know, we typically when you see me show up, I'm here to talk to you about procedural law, substantive law, things of that nature. But today we're going to do something. We spent a lot of time in municipal court handling traffic cases. And we handle so many traffic cases that sometimes we don't even really think about traffic, why we're handling these cases, how we got to where we are with these cases. It's just another folder file. Today we're going to go ahead and stop. We're going to go ahead and do something different this morning. It's going to be it's going to be a little different. I'll tell you right now. Let me set your expectations. You're going to find, for those of you who've been coming to these conferences for a long time, and how many of you have? How many of you have been coming to these conferences for a very long time? Yeah, this is going to be a little bit different. So and I think that variety is the spice of life. This is more like TMCEC programming meet. By the way, I'm not sure if y'all have noticed this. How many of y'all watch the History Channel? You watch it? There is a lot of stuff on the History Channel that I beg to differ if it actually deserves to be on the History Channel. Case in point, I'm not so sure that the Alaskan Ice Truckers Road has any real historical ties. On the same vein, as much as I love swamp people, I'm not so sure that a show about a guy named Kenwood who goes around with his daddy and shoots alligators with a .22 has much of a historical tie. And then what was the other one that they had? Did y'all see the one, the Top Shot, where every week the people are having the shooting competition? Well, you know, I love that thing, but that could have just as well been on some cable guy. Nevertheless, I love those shows. We are going to, like I said, so this is going to be a little bit different. And I'm going to talk to you personally, too. This is going to be interactive in the sense that I'm going to get you to kind of reflect on yourself and the relationship that you have with your automobile, okay? And the relationship that you've had with past automobiles. So we're going to go way, way back, and we're going to talk about your very first car, okay? So America has a love affair with automobiles. I mean, it is just a fact. I mean, how many of you have been to a car show? You've been to a car show before. How many of you have been to the state fair and you go there to see the new models of cars that they're debuting at the state fair? Do you remember the first time you drove? Do you remember the first time someone gave you the keys to the car and you were able to go somewhere by yourself? Do you remember that? These are moments that people tend to remember. Do you remember your first car? Okay, well, I remember mine, and here's a picture of it. Let me tell you about this bad boy. This is a 1968 Oldsmobile Delmont 88, not to be confused with the Delta, because that was the mid-grade model, okay? This is a Delmont 88. I inherited this car when my 84-year-old great died. The car had a blue book value, I think, of about $840. The car it was mascara green. It was four-door. It had no cassette tape deck, okay? It had an air conditioner that blew very cold, and it had a 425 V8 engine, okay? Which meant that when you put that pedal down, if you gave it enough time, there's no telling on God's green earth how fast that thing could actually go. I will also tell you that my recollection is the thing got about negative 11 miles to the gallon. But it didn't really matter back then because gasoline cost 89 cents a gallon, okay? And so so this is my first car. And you know, I've also put up some lyrics that came to mind when I started thinking about our people's relationship with cars. This is a Bruce Springsteen song off of the Nebraska album. And you really can't tell if he's talking about a car or his girlfriend because the terms are almost interchangeable. So let me ask y'all, when you think back on your cars, so what was your first car? Y'all tell me, what were you driving? Very first car. Who wants to go first? You? Tell me. 71 Datsun, all right. 71 Pinto. My condolences. All right. All right. Yes. 52 Chevy Coupe. 63 Corvair. Oh, there's more on the Corvair coming later on in my presentation. All right. 77 Chrysler LeBaron, ma'am. Hey, don't remember. What year? 50? 50 Ford convertible? Anyone that's about this side of the room? Got anything to share with me? You had a 63 Corvair as well. All right. We're glad that the two of y'all are still alive. All right. Anyone else? You don't remember the year? Okay. 1984 Ford pickup. All right. Well, look, you know, think about this. Think about this. These chariots, if you will. Okay. Especially if you're like me, if you were raised in rural Texas, I don't actually consider this part of the state to be home. I was raised in Vernon, Texas. And how many of y'all know where Vernon is? I mean, Vernon's kind of hard to classify. We're not, North Texans don't claim us as North Texas. We're too far northwest. People in the panhandle don't claim us either because, you know, that doesn't become the panhandle until you officially break that invisible line right along the location of Childress. We were the Red River Valley, which I always thought was funny because there sure as hell is no valley in that part of Texas. It's flat and mesquite trees and red dirt, and that's it, okay? Growing up in a small town, you look at a car, man, it's symbolic. You think, this is how I'm going to get out of this place. This is how I'm going to get to a better place. Even on weekends, this is how, if you were lucky enough to have a date and you really liked her, you could go to Wichita Falls and have a real urban experience. We mythologize cars, we celebrate cars, we live in our cars. How many of you love your cars? How many of you love your cars right now? Okay. How many of you would admit that you've had relationships? You know, it's like, yeah, this is an important part of my life is this car. How many of you have cars that you like more than your ex-husbands? All right. There you go. Ex-husbands, ex-spouses, what have you. All right. And so that's what I'm talking about. And it's interesting to see we've gotten this relationship. But the thing is, it's a mixed bag. Because with every type of the advent of technology, you know, with every blessing, there is a curse. And the number of people who have been killed and the people who have been seriously injured and maimed in automobiles since the advent of these things, the mass commercial availability of them, it exceeds all the people who have been killed in world wars. Okay, and we still know that today in Texas that cars are the number one killers of our children. Okay, there are going to be more people who are between the ages of 16 and 25 who are going to be killed in cars than are going to be killed by cancer and that are going to be killed by guns. And that's something that's sobering. So when you get these technologies, you recognize that it's truly a double-edged sword. On one hand, this is like, you know, possibly the key to our dreams, professionally, socially, occupationally. You know, if you're in some dead-end town and your goal is to get out, this is a big-ass state. Probably your best chance is to catch a ride in a car, okay? And so because of that, what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about how we got to where we are now. And we're going to talk about some historical milestones in the advent of automobiles. And at the same time, I'm going to keep coming back to y'all, and I'm going to ask you to think about your attitudes, your thoughts, your relationship with automobiles. Because many of you have experienced the evolution of traffic safety, the evolution of the automobile. And guess what? Even if you're not very old, okay, it's happening right now. We are struggling in this state right now with the relationship that we're going to have with our cars and our smartphones, okay? And what's the role of a smartphone inside an automobile when it's moving? And that might sound like a no-brainer, but it's actually a very complicated question because you can say something's a bad idea, but trying to get it passed through a legislative process and signed into law by a governor is not an easy process, all right? So let's go way back. I'm going to talk to you. We're going to start off. We're going to take you way back in time. We're hopping our little TMC EC time machine. We're going to jet on back, and we're going to go so far back in time, we're going to actually go to a different continent as well. Americans have a very American-centric understanding of history. We tend to think that everything happened in America. We tend to think that, Jesus Christ spoke English, okay? It's true, there's a poll on this. Have y'all seen that poll of how many Americans were polled thought that Jesus spoke English? Okay. We tend to think that, you know, who invented the car? People say Henry Ford. That's absolutely wrong. Okay, Henry Ford did not invent the car. Okay, Henry Ford made the car available so that we could all buy one. That's a true statement. Okay, but Henry Ford did not invent the car. And most efforts to try to create an automobile actually occurred over in Europe. And there was a race among many inventors. And one of these guys who was there was this guy, Nicholas Joseph Cugnot. And Nicholas has a very, probably, this is not what he wants to be known for, but Nicholas Joseph Cugnot is historically famous as being the very first person who ever crashed a car. Okay? Happened in 1771. He did a pretty good job of inventing a contraption that would move, that was powered by steam. Unfortunately, he had not perfected something that we like to refer to now as brakes. Okay, so here is actually a depiction of Nicholas Joseph Cugnot shining 15 minutes in history when this poor guy crashed his invention into a wall and became known as the first person on the planet Earth to ever crash a car. All right, now, 1865. I mean, look at him. We're almost talking 100 years later. Almost 100 years later, a legislative body decides that there should be some effort to pass a law regulating how people use what we call a car, which at the time was referred to in the common vernacular as a locomotive. Believe it or not, I know you think a locomotive is that's going to be a train. But a locomotive at one point, you know, meant anything that could pull itself along. That's what a locomotive was. And in 1865, over in the UK, they passed a law. And I want you to look at this through your modern eyes, but think about at the time what it must have been like to enforce this law. Because what we always see, we see it every session. We're going to see it, you know, how many of you are coming to see us in August at one of the legislative updates? Will you all be coming back then? All right. Well, you're going to see it then. It's easy for me to say, you know what, we ought to pass a law that creates a 10-cent court cost. Okay, that's easy for me to say. Then we find out by the time it goes through the legislative process and the governor signs it, then it turns out we find out it costs the state over $8 million to implement a 10-cent court cost that collects $30,000. People go, oh, wait a minute. We've had a failure to make this thing work. And the same is true in traffic laws. You know, y'all remember when they passed the law a couple years ago that said if you come in contact with an emergency vehicle on the side of the road that you've got to pull over two lanes? Do you remember that? Or reduce your speed to at least 20 miles an hour? Remember that? Problem, of course, is that you don't always have a lane to pull over into. And the problem also is that they didn't contemplate every variety of roadway that we had when they said that. So you always see the implementation of these laws in traffic. It always poses problems for local courts. So imagine being a court clerk in the year 1865 over in England, and here is the very first traffic law they ever passed, okay? It says that there's going to be a speed limit of 2 miles an hour in towns, 4 miles an hour out of town, and requires a man with a red flag to walk 60 yards ahead of qualifying powered vehicles. All right, I want to make sure you're clear on this. If you owned a car, you had to be rich, not only rich enough to have a car, you had to be rich enough to have an advance team, a manservant, some dude waving a red flag out ahead of you. All right, now, the distance was reduced in 1878 to 20 yards. Okay, yeah, literally, you'd have an entourage, so like President Obama shows up and he has an advance team. If you owned a car, you had to have an advance team get ahead of you anytime you went anywhere, swinging the red flag. Anybody want to guess why you had to swing that red flag? Because some people hadn't seen cars, and they didn't want old ladies to have heart attacks. Okay. Also, because of the fact, and here's a big one, okay, you didn't want to spook horses. Okay, you weren't supposed to spook the horses. Now, keep in mind, too, in 1865, there weren't no stop signs either. So what were you going to do if you had horse and buggy coming one direction and you had a locomotive coming the other direction? Pose some real serious public safety hazards, all right? Well, this is my favorite part of it. Vehicles were required to stop on the side of a horse. I guess it must have sucked to be the guy with the red flag if you said, whoop, here's another horse, got to stop again, okay? And then here's truly the most comical part of this law. The speed limit being effectively redundant as vehicles could not exceed the speed at which a person could walk. Okay? So, in other words, the poor advanced, the poor guy with a flag, they're saying, can you hurry your ass up? I mean, I'm waving this flag and we're not going anywhere, okay? Yeah, you got it. People walking were faster than people driving the cars because the cars couldn't go faster than 4 miles an hour. And you got some guy who's like, hey, how are you with my red flag here? All right, so, okay, that brings us to the year 1869. Let me tell you a little bit about Mary Ward. Mary Ward was an amazing woman for any time. She was especially an amazing woman for the year 1869. She was a trained chemist. She was a scientist, a woman of science, came from a family of scientists. And she has a very sad historical distinction because Mary Ward is the very first person who was ever killed in an automobile. We know this. She was the very first person to ever be killed in an automobile. She was killed in August the 31st, 1869. One of her cousins was trying to perfect the automobile, and she was riding on this prototype, and she fell out of the vehicle and was crushed by one of the wheels. Okay. And so this is tragic. Now, this did not happen. In fact, my recollection has happened in Ireland. But let me just say this, you fast forward, you take a look at the next name I've got for you, this gentleman here. And this is Henry Bliss, and he is the first American who would be killed by an automobile. And he was killed in 1899 in downtown New York City in Manhattan. And on the 100th anniversary of his death, the city of New York placed a marker to mark the spot where the first American was ever killed by an automobile, and began having a discussion with people in New York City about how many people have been killed in automobiles since Henry Bliss was first killed in 1890. Notice, too, I mean, we're talking about, you know, we talk about 30 years. It would be 30 years between the time that the first person was killed by a car and the first time an American was killed by an automobile. All right. Now, 1895, John Henry Knight. This is actually John Henry Knight and his spouse. Mr. Knight was also an entrepreneur, an inventor of sorts. He was also a guy this is an American who was engaged in a race to try to perfect an automobile that could be sold commercially. John Henry Knight, first person to ever get a traffic ticket, charged with the offense of using a locomotive without a license in 1895. Okay, think of this as being the historical, he's the great, 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 great granddaddy of everyone you've ever seen in your court been charged with no DL. Okay. That's who John Henry Knight is in our legal system. He is considered to be our nation's first traffic offender. Okay, 1905, the American Automobile Association is organized. I'm curious, do I have any people in here who are members of AAA? Do I have any AAA members in here? None. All right, well, good. I'll make sure not to call any of you off my car breaks now. You know, we think about AAA as being an organization that, you know, comes and provides roadside assistance. Someone who will come and you can go to AAA before you and your family are going to go on a bigger road trip, and they'll give you road maps. We think of them that way, but it's hard to imagine that back in 1905 that there were certain members of Congress who held the AAA in such disdain that they were viewed very similarly to as the Bolsheviks or the Communist Party, because AAA was an outspoken group that was trying to advocate against national laws regulating the use of automobiles. Okay, they did not want, they thought that if you wanted to own a car, that's like you owning a bicycle. And the government does not make you register your bicycles, so the government should never make you register a car. And they thought that the whole idea of registering automobiles would lead to a system in which the government would have too much information about you. Okay. Thought that they also believed that if they registered your cars, the next thing you know, they'd start trying to tax you on your cars. And by the way, everything that they feared would happen actually has happened, okay? Y'all don't know this because y'all are Texans. Y'all pay a vehicle registration, right? Y'all pay that. But in other states, there is actually a tax. And God, it sounded like it was right out of the ceiling, didn't it? Am I being called home? Sounds like a... So anyway, it was... Lost my thought there. Let's see if I can regroup on that. All right. So, yeah, they feared that basically they thought that you should have the right to own property unencumbered by the government. And I'm not sure if y'all know this, but in other states, there is actually an annual motor vehicle tax. Did y'all know that? Any of y'all ever lived in a state that had an annual motor vehicle tax? Well, they take a look at how much your car is worth, and then they charge you a tax based off of the value of your car. So every year you're paying a tax on cars. You lived in a place like that? Well, I was having that thought too, but sir, you have to understand, this is Texas, and we oppose taxes. So we'll just call it a court cost, a fee. You know, we find other ways to snake you out of your money. But good point. No, you're right. He's absolutely right, because how much you pay for your vehicle registration is absolutely based, not off of the value, though. It's based off of the year. Okay, but your point is still well taken. You know, it looks a heck of a lot like a tax, doesn't it? Okay. So let me tell you how this actually, they even got to the point where they were telling folks that, when states started passing speeding laws, they said, well, we don't remember this type of regulation of horses, so we think this is outrageous that now we're going to regulate, if these are horseless carriages, then people should be able to use these things the same way that you'd use a horse, and the government never regulated our horses like this. Well, they actually started creating a campaign where they would tell you in advance where people were trying to conduct traffic law enforcement, where speed traps. Their whole goal was to tell you in advance where speed traps were. Back in Washington, D.C., certain members of Congress thought that these cars were dangerous, that people would end up getting hurt in cars. They were right. And that we needed to have a national effort to try to, the states needed to take efforts, and local governments needed to take the efforts to address these problems, to not let people get hurt and killed in these cars. And so certain members of Congress said, well, let me get this straight. AAA is going to organize to try to tell people where your local government is going to try to have speed traps. Well, that means essentially they're going to try to facilitate and assist people in, hurting other folks. And that's the reason why in 1905 certain members of Congress held them. Y'all remember the Bolsheviks? I'm talking about the communists, folks. I'm talking about what would later become, the revolution of 1911. We're talking about the Communist Party. They were viewed in that type of disdain as being a threat to Americans. Now, to show you how some things never change, history repeats itself time and time again. How many of you have an iPhone? I'm sure someone in this room has an iPhone. Okay, you got an iPhone. Do you like your iPhone? I love my iPhone. I love it. Only thing I don't like is I don't like iTunes. I don't like the fact that the only way I can update my operating system is by going through iTunes. I think that the Droid people have it better. They don't have to do that. They can update their operating system, but they don't have as many cool apps, okay? And let me talk to you about one of the apps that is available for an iPhone. There is an app for the iPhone that uses the GPS in the phone so that when you drive and you see a cop, you just tap your screen. And it sends it back to a national database, and it compiles and uses GPS, and it builds a national map of where law enforcement are known to hang out when they're doing speed enforcement, okay? And you can get this, you can buy this app from the iTunes store, and you can get a map, and every time you are in a known area, because if you allow it to track your location, it will send you a message. It will beep and say, pop, 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 pop. It will tell you you are coming upon an area which is known by another user of the app as being a place where law enforcement has been located. Okay, kind of sounds like something AAA would have done back in 1905, okay? Now, let me even tell you the best part of the story. I don't even think Kathy's heard this story. Senator John McCain found out about this app and went on TV and did a press conference stating that the maker of this app was engaged in reckless behavior that was a threat to the safety of the American people, okay? Just like Congress did in 1905 when they were pointing their finger of shame at AAA. So some things just never change. I mean, here we are. What is this? 106 years later, we're seeing essentially the exact same thing. But we're seeing it through the lens of new technologies. Okay? Some things never change. All right? They also opposed some things that I think, are ridiculous. They opposed driver's license, too. They thought that you shouldn't have to have a driver's license. You never had to have a driver's license to ride a horse. That was one of their favorite arguments. Okay? All right. 1931. You can imagine if people in Washington, D.C., are having this discussion, that in Texas we have had our own discussion about traffic laws. And essentially what we did from the advent of the automobiles is we let cities and counties make up their own rules. And I don't know how you feel about this, but I, for one, don't think it's a very good idea that, if you're driving in El Paso, there might be one traffic law, and by the time you get to Eastland, an entirely different law would apply. Okay, I'm not one of those guys to think that, you know, it's okay to have one set of rules in Weatherford, but another set of rules altogether when you get to Wimberley. Those things, it's not good policy. So the state of Texas began creating laws and authorizing cities and counties to adopt laws, but they had to be uniform. And I know that none of you are old enough to remember this, but some of you may have actually seen either pictures or if you've ever gone to an antique store. Have any of y'all ever seen a four-sided yellow stop sign? Have you ever seen them? They're very valuable, and you can buy them at antique stores. Because prior to the efforts of states to regulate traffic control devices, you know, today, you know, I've done a lot of work in the last month working in Dripping Springs. We're doing all types of new traffic ordinances. And every time we want to put a new speed sign, all those signs are regulated through a book called, what's it called, Kathy? The Uniform Traffic Control Device. Yeah, and it's the cookbook of traffic signs. You can't put up a sign unless it's a uniform sign. You know, a stop sign in your town has to look like a stop sign in my town. And if you think about it, well, hell, that's not just common sense. That's a real good idea, okay? But back in 1931, this whole idea of stop signs, well, this is newfangled technology. I mean, even the whole ideas of, well, what would a stoplight look like and how would a stoplight be powered? The first stoplight actually had a guy standing in a tower who had to, like, put wires together. And I'm not lying. That was the first stop sign. I mean, the first red light. Well, a lot of our political heroes back in the time thought that this was just crazy. We shouldn't have, when you're out there on the open roads of Texas, this is a big state, takes you a long time to get anywhere you want to go. I mean, this place is like 850 miles by 875 miles. It's a big state, right? Getting around is hard. And the last thing that some of your political heroes wanted was for you to be encumbered by some cop. So we actually passed a law in Texas that said that a peace officer could not stop a person for committing a traffic offense unless the offender could see the peace officer at the time they were committing the offense. Really? Okay? You know, how would you ever prove that? You probably never could. You can see that the legislature is trying to stack the deck against law enforcement. Well, it's not even over. It gets worse. They also passed a law that said that you had to be properly dressed. You had to have a pant. You had to wear a pair of pants that were the proper color. I think they had to be gray or blue. They had to be properly ironed and starched with a crease in the center of the leg. You had to have a badge. The badge had to be gold. Had to have like 5 or 6 points on the star. Had to be located on the left hand. I mean, what the hell's going on? Are we talking about law enforcement or fashion police here? Okay? And this was all done by the Texas legislature to try to make sure that Texans could never get a speeding ticket. Can you imagine that? Think of the mindset. Does that sound like the mindset today when you hear about people passing all these laws about, you know, click it or ticket? You think, I mean, click it or ticket is almost accepted policy now, right? Not back in 1931. Of course, in 1931, there was not even such thing as a seatbelt available in an automobile, but more on that in a little bit. The Texas Court of Criminal Appeals ultimately ended up getting this case. And y'all know the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals. We love the Court of Criminal Appeals. Why? One, because people who worked there were kind enough to give Kathy and I our first jobs. That's one reason. Everyone likes to have their first job. And secondly, because of the fact that they control the funds that they fund the TMCEC. So we like the Court of Criminal Appeals. Court of Criminal Appeals gets this case, and they end up shooting this whole law down, and they go, wait a minute. The job of the legislature is to create the laws. The job of law enforcement is to engage in law enforcement. What the legislature is doing here has nothing to do with anything other than trying to micromanage law enforcement conduct, and they declared all those laws to be invalid, and they shot them all down. I'll tell you the funny thing, though. I'm not sure if Kathy's ever seen this, but we still, at TMCEC, every now and then, will get a judge or a prosecutor calling us stating that some defendant has shown up in municipal court and they want to cite a Court of Criminal Appeals decision from 1928, which stated that a cop may not write a ticket unless at the time that they write the ticket, and they fall back. So they don't know that these laws were all shot down in 1931. But that just shows you that the mindset of 1931, were politicians in Austin, were they really concerned about traffic safety in 1931? No, they were concerned about your freedom and your ability to be let alone by government. Okay, that's really where the focus was in 1931. Okay, 1930, Clare Strait and C.J. Strickland. These are people that I would like you to introduce you to as well. These are physicians, and they are pioneers of automobile safety. There are someone who we ought to know their names. They're not. There are plenty of people who contribute to our society, practice their own form of human art to make the world a better place, that you never learn their names. But let me tell you why you should know these people. These are the people who describe the type of cranial and facial injuries that were caused by car wrecks, and it was the first time that there was ever anyone attempted to try to make people think about what happens inside of a car when the car crashes. Prior to that, the focus of the American automobile industry was exclusively on how does the car look, okay? Absolutely on superficial aesthetics. And many of y'all remember this because this is really a trend, especially for those of you who were born in the 1940s or the 1950s or the 1960s, even as late as the 1970s, that the real focus of cars has always been on what's next, the next model. You remember when Americans used to trade off cars every 3 or 4 years so they could show up driving to church in the newest car? That was where the focus was always on. It was on the design, you know, what's the face of the car look like, you know? Back when cars had fins, you know, it's all about design. Well, these folks said, well, stop, wait a minute. What about when you crash and you're inside this car? Keep in mind, in 1930s, I've already told you, there were no seat belts in automobiles, okay? What were these dashes made out of? Steel. Yes, steel, chrome, all right, wood. That's what these cars were made out of. All right, and, you know, these folks said, you know what we need? We need padded dashboards. We need seat belts. There are something simple we could do that would actually reduce the number of fatalities and injuries. Let me ask y'all, anyone here, there hasn't been a single room I've spoken to all year long in which I haven't had at least one person that when I poll on this question, they don't raise their hands. So let's see if the trend continues all the way to the very end. Is there anyone in this car, in this room, who's ever been involved in, doesn't have to be a serious car wreck, but even a minor car wreck, where they ended up getting a gash or a scratch or have a scar somewhere on their body that was caused by some interior component of the dash? Okay, so not anyone else? There's not a single room that I've been all year in which there hasn't been one. My mom has one. From when she was a freshman in college, she was driving to Altus, Oklahoma, and they hit ice on a bridge, and she ended up hitting her head on the knob, okay? Or actually, I think she ended up hitting her knees against the knobs on the radio, and she still to this day has scars from where she hit the dash, okay? Because this is definitely not a 1930s car, but it still illustrates the trend. I mean, what is the most notable feature about this dash? How shiny and pretty it is. Absolutely perfect to maim you with, okay? By the way, let me also point out, absolutely perfect to blind you with if you're driving it on a sunny day in Odessa, Texas, okay? Hell, that thing's so bright, you might blind someone in the car next to you driving down the road. I mean, truly, okay? So that's 1930s. Now, the response with the automakers when they start having this discussion is, basically, they're not responsive. Because that's not what American car making was about. It was about making beautiful cars that people wanted to buy and making sure that the stockholders made money that year. That's what it was about. Making cars was about making money, not about making people safe. That's one thing I do want you to file away in your mind. That is a historical theme of America. The cars have been about money, not about safety. Okay, now it's going to change, but you're going to see how long it takes us to get there. Here's the next thing I want you to start. Just observe this right now. Listen to me now and hear me later, okay? From the moment that there is an awakening, that there is a problem when it comes to cars and traffic safety, there is historically always been a 20 to 30 year lag. So in other words, if I tell you that a certain type of design stinks, that design will tend to exist for 30 more years before they do something else. If I tell you that we can save lives by doing A, B, or C, from the time it's commonly accepted, it takes 20 or 30 years before it's either required to be put in a car or before your government's willing to step up and make it required under law. Part of that, I think, goes back to what I've already talked to you about, this notion of this kind of this libertarian notion that you have to let people alone. Don't tell them what they have to do in their cars. It's their car. Let them do what they want to do in their cars. It kind of goes back to our libertarian roots about property ownership, okay? All right, 1934, General Motors performs its first crash test. The response from Ford and Chrysler is, why would you crash a perfectly fine operating car? They think this is a ridiculous waste of cars. You could have sold that car. Why did you crash that car? We know now, of course, that this is the beginning of something that we're going to talk about more that has really saved lives. When we start figuring out how these cars perform when they're involved in simulated accidents. Okay, 1940, the United States government adopts its first equipment regulation on automobiles. Let me make this clear to you. So in other words, 1940, this is the very first time the federal government exercises its power and says, you can't sell a car in this country unless it has a certain piece of equipment on it. Here's your hint. This piece of equipment would remain virtually unchanged for 40 years. Okay, what do you think it was? Okay, seat belts, good guess. What else do I hear? Okay, bumpers, that would be good. That'd be good. We'd like to think that they had those things. Anyone else? I've had other people say, steering wheel. Are you serious? Did you just say steering? You should be ashamed of yourself. Put your head down. No. I had someone say that yesterday next door. I've heard windshield wipers, okay? And believe it or not, yep, and the answer is headlights. So I want to make sure you're clear on this. Prior to 1940, there was not even a requirement in this country that cars even come with headlights, okay? Now, for those of you who are shocked, that's part of the point of this presentation. The evolution of traffic safety involves the fact that those things which we take for granted is just being, you know, as we like to say in terms of legal terms, re ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. We don't have to explain it. It is because it is. It's not always is. It takes time for people. Get this. Prior to the 1940s, headlights were optional equipment. Some headlights you had to glue onto your car. Okay. Some of them were powered by kerosene. Some of them used batteries. You would have to get out and turn on a battery on each side of your car before you would drive. Okay. There was a debate about how many headlights should you have. Should you have two? Should you have one that's center-mounted? There was no agreement on any of this stuff, okay? Today, we take that for granted. There's no such thing as a car that doesn't have headlights. And by the way, the number of people who were killed prior to the 1940s after dusk is the most dangerous time to drive. I wonder why. Maybe it's because you couldn't see that steel torpedo hauling down the road coming your way. All right. 1942, Hugh DeHaven publishes the classic mechanical analysis of survival and falls from heights of 50 to 150 feet. Hugh DeHaven survived an airplane crash and he had survivor's guilt. He wanted to know why everyone else in his airplane died while he lived. And one of the things that he was able to figure out is that he was in a part of an airplane that had an aluminum cage built around it. This thing's become known as a crash cage. And he began advocating that cars be built not around just the platform that the car sits on top of, that the body sits on top of. That's how cars have historically been made. You've got the engine, you've got the frame, and you just set the car on top of it, but also to integrate into that a cage around the automobile. This idea is rejected by all American car makers. And the idea was, why would anyone want to have a cage around them while they drive their car? There was concerns about how these cages would affect the aesthetic components. By the way, for all of you who drive cars that have been made in the last 10 years, every single car has what's now a crash cage or a crumple zone. This idea is now commonly accepted as a way that we can save people's lives when accidents occur. But back in 1942, it was rejected. More on Hugh DeHaven in a minute. 1948, Preston Tucker develops a car that's known as the Tucker Torpedo. Now, many of you, probably, if you have ever heard of Preston Tucker, the chances are you have heard of Preston Tucker because of the movie that had Jeff Bridges that came out in the 1980s called Tucker, A Man in His Dreams. I don't think that movie did very well at the box office, but it did a pretty good job of telling the story of a guy who had an idea of how he could make a car that would be better than any of the cars that were being sold by the three major car makers. As you notice, the Tucker Torpedo had three headlights, okay? It also had padded dashboards. It also was the first car to come standardly equipped with safety glass and with a lap belt. And these were all ideas that were a threat to the major car makers because he thought this is just something that a car should come with. These people were like, well, that's going to cost money. That's not figured into our profit structure. It's going to affect the bottom line. Have any of you ever seen a Tucker Torpedo? Anyone ever seen one? I'm going to go see one soon. In fact, I might go see one this weekend with my five-year-old because I learned on the way back from San Antonio that there is some place in either New Braunfels or San Marcos where this guy has his own car exhibit. He has a collection of classic cars, and I saw the ad coming back from the traffic safety conference in San Antonio, and he has a Tucker Torpedo, and this is a very rare car. There were only a couple hundred of these things ever made, and one of the reasons was he had all these great features, but get this, he didn't even have enough engines. For all the frames that he had built. He finished these cars out but didn't have enough engines to put in them. How many of you saw the movie? Have any of you seen the movie? Do you remember the scene in the movie where they're going to try to show off the car for the very first time and they had to push the car off onto the stage and then run back and then open the curtain and then they show the car and then they close the curtain and they never can let the audience know that they don't have an engine for the automobile. Okay? Okay. Well, let me tell you something else. The ideas that the Tucker Torpedo had that people thought were kind of comical, and to show you once again how history has a weird way of affecting our view of things. The Tucker Torpedo also had headlights, one of the headlights, I can't remember if it's the center one or the one, I think it's the center one, was actually attached to a series of pulleys that went back to the steering column. And when you turn the wheel, that center headlight would go wherever the wheel of the car was turned. Because the engineers concluded that that would make you safer, that you would have the ability to have a better view of the road. Of course, this was widely laughed at by all the rest of the car makers. However, flash forward to the year 2010, how many of you have seen the Mercedes-Benz ad, which involved, they talk about how if you'll buy this Mercedes-Benz, you'll be in a car that uses lasers. That fires laser beams down the highway and uses it to manage the direction of your headlights, okay? So once again, you see how these things, you know, maybe there was no lasers involved in 1948, but this idea was certainly there in 1948. Okay, back to Hugh DeHaven. In 1949, he finally convinces a car maker that this idea of incorporating a crash cage into an automobile has merit. And Saab is the first car to do it. Saab 92. Here's a photograph of a Saab 92. Notice the location of the handle to open the door. I get a big kick out of it. I don't think that's a bad-looking car either, especially considering the year that it was made. So this is the first car to have a safety cage built into it. Now, to kind of play this thing a little bit forward, you know, for those of you who watch a lot of TV like me, you may actually remember a couple things. One is that Saab was purchased by GM. Okay, it's an American car company now. It was until GM bit the dirt and went through a corporate reorganization. But they had an ad campaign beginning, I think, in 2008, and I think they just concluded it in 2010, where every time they would try to sell you a Saab on TV, they would always say, born from jets. How many of you remember that campaign? You ever hear them talking about Saab's been born from jets? Well, that's what they were talking about. It's a reference to the fact that Saab was the first car to ever try to incorporate the safety features into it that we associate with airplanes. And by the way, I want to point this out to you too. The seatbelt that you put on when you fly on Southwest Airlines is exactly the same type of seatbelt that first appeared in automobiles when they finally did make their way into the design of cars. All right, moving on. In 1956, the Ford Motor Company decides that they're going to market the Lifeguard Safety Package. Okay, this is the first time that American car makers have flirted with the notion of making traffic safety or making the safety of the passenger or something is going to be part of an automobile. But of course, it's optional equipment. It's a package you had to buy. You had to buy a 56 Ford, and then get this. Here are the things that for extra money you could get. For extra money, you could get a steering wheel that would not kill you or impale you, okay? You could get a dashboard that would not bludgeon you or fracture your skull. You could get a seat belt that would stop you from flying through the windshield. And my all-time favorite, you could get doors that would not bust open and throw your ass out of the car as it's rolling over down the highway. Now, this is really hard for me to fathom, that this is something that they were selling you. Yeah, in other words, if you didn't want to buy it, you got a 56 Ford that had a wheel that would kill you, a dashboard that would kill you, a door that would fly open, and no way of physically keeping yourself in place in the car. Okay? Guess what? Americans did not buy the safety package. They did not buy the lifeguard safety package. And at the end of the year 1956, Edsel Ford is quoted as saying, in the year 1956, while our competitors have been busy selling cars, we've been busy trying to sell safety packages. Scrub it. Move on. I want to make money for our stockholders. And so that was the end of this. Maybe it was just the fact that they didn't know that cute little bears are good at preventing fires, but not good at selling auto safety. I don't know. Okay. 1958, Nils Bohlen invents and has a patent on something that's called the three-point safety restraint. And the United Nations calls on all car makers around the world to use the three-point restraint as a standard bearer for how cars should be made to keep people safe. Here's the funny thing. The United Nations is not very popular in 1958 in the United States of America. There were a lot of people who associate the UN with socialist and communist and all this other nonsense, so they want nothing to do with it. American car makers, once again, have nothing to do with the three-point safety belt. Fast forward to the year 2011, none of you are driving a car that does not have a three-point safety restraint in it, okay? Okay, but it took us a while for us to get to that point. In fact, Volvo is the first company to adopt the three-point safety restraint. You're starting to see a trend here, aren't you, about Saab and Volvo. It's a perpetual trend. You're always going to see it. Saab and Volvo are like always first on the scene when it comes to safety advances. All right. 1959, IIHS is created, the Institute for Insurance Highway Safety, and they began doing their own crash tests. Now, this is what they figure out. They figure out that it costs more to fix some cars than it does others, and maybe before you insure a car, you might want to know how much it costs to fix the car. And this is when we start figuring out that maybe some cars are crappier than others, okay? We figure that out by crashing them together and figuring how much it costs to put them back together again. It's kind of the Humpty Dumpty effect, all right? Well, there is this notion, and y'all have all heard this notion. They don't build them like they used to, you know. Many of you have had the same frustration I have. If you've ever, I'll tell you a personal one, good example. I went on a quest to buy a water sprinkler for my yard, okay, that would not break, okay, in the first year or first 3 months I had. I wanted to buy a solid steel sprinkler made in the United States of America of the same quality that my grandfather would have owned in the 1970s or 80s. That was my quest. By the way, I found one. Okay, just to let you know, Gilmore made a solid steel American-made sprinkler. I found out they've now discontinued it. They're all made in Mexico and China now. All right. Now, I say that because you've heard this thing. Well, you see these cars. You know, this is a car, and it's to a certain degree it's true. You know, I remember in my '68 Oldsmobile, I hit a tree once. I mean, I didn't even hit it. I just kind of backed into it or moved forward and bumped it. I completely uplifted the tree. But it didn't do a damn thing to my car, okay? And it kind of fosters this phony notion, you know, that, well, you know, hey, this is, you know, you want to keep your kids safe, you need to put them in a real car, you got to put them in one of these cars. Well, we're going to debunk that a little bit. I want to show you, this is to celebrate the 50th anniversary of the IIHS. In 2009, they took a 2009 Chevrolet Malibu and a 1959 Chevrolet Impala. And they went ahead and did a head-to-head collision. And I'm going to go ahead and show you the results. So let's go ahead and check this out. Yep, they don't make them like they used to. Let's watch this in slow-mo. As you can see, while the the interior of the 59 Impala is absolutely just demolished. It can only be described as having the physics inside of like an improvised explosive device. The amount of glass, you can actually see fluids enter the passenger compartment. The passenger compartment is essentially disintegrated in the 1959 Impala, despite the fact the car is made of almost solid steel. Nothing but sheet metal and steel. In contrast, check out the interior. Look at that steering wheel. Okay. Now contrast that to what's going on in the 2009 Chevrolet Malibu, where you have the interior of the car has an airbag. Watch this and compare it to what you saw in the other car. The crumple zones, the crash cage, the seat belt, completely different. So once again, they don't make them like they used to. Damn straight, they don't. Cars today are much safer. Those cars may have been beautiful, okay? But like my mom used to say about girls, just because they're pretty doesn't make them safe, okay? So it's one of those deals that we think that because these cars had more steel in them that they must have been better. And in reality, those cars that are lighter, that even though they might have plastic, even though they might have foam, they're actually safer to be inside those cars. All right. 1964, Volvo develops its first rear-facing seatbelt. August 2010, my wife and I develop our first and only daughter. Okay, so anyway, here's the funny thing. You know, you think about where we are in terms of how we transport our kids. And this is something else that we deal with in municipal courts every day. We see kids, people who are cited for not having their children restrained. We see them cited for not having their kids in child safety seats. We see them for not having their kids in booster seats. We see this all the time. And the thing that is so hard to imagine that it's 1964 is the year that the first rear-facing child safety seat is developed. Okay, I was born in 1972, and I recently came across a photograph of my mom and dad taking me home from St. David's Hospital in Austin, Texas. And the only thing I can say is that I'm being carried in something looks like it's akin to something you would expect to see a child playing with on a beach in a piece of Tupperware. That's the only thing I can describe it as. It does not look like, it looks like a tray, okay? I asked my mom, she said there was no way to mount the tray into a seat belt or anything like that. She said that, you probably would have been safer if you took a little kid and put them on the floorboard of the back seat of the car than what people did. You know, and you see these type of behaviors. I mean, y'all think about it yourselves. How many of you have children that are grown? How many of you have grown children? Do you remember when they were little? Many of you, you drive down the road, and you would have your kids standing up on the front seat with you, and if you step on the brake, you thought you could use that fictitional mom arm guard that would suspend all the rules of physics. You also used to clean your kid's face using your own spit, but enough of that. Okay, my point is still well taken. So think of it this. This is 1964. You would not see any laws requiring people to use child safety seats until late 80s? Early 90s? Okay, more on that in a second. We're going to talk about more on that in a second. All right. Now, 1965. Okay, you Corvair users, let's talk about the Corvair. What year did you have again? 63. What year did you have? You had a 63 as well? Okay. 1965, Ralph Nader published his book, Unsafe at Any Speeds, and this is the most explosive and influential bestseller of the decade about the designed dangers in American automobiles. He's blowing the whistle on GM. GM knows that the rear axle of the Corvair has a pivoting point. The axle would actually float. So in other words, most axles are uniform, okay? Not in the Corvair. It could do this. So what would happen is if you got to the edge of a road that had a big shoulder, one wheel would go off the shoulder. It would be on one plane, while the other axle would be on a different plane, and the car had front-wheel drive. I think it had front-wheel drive, didn't it? Okay. And what that would result in is the car being pulled and twisted and throwing you down the highway at highway speeds. You would basically, you'd crash, lose control. GM knows about this. They don't do anything about it. Of course, cars don't have seat belts either. They're not required to back in this period of time. And GM is now being accused of knowingly selling cars that are dangerous. They decide that they're going to destroy Ralph Nader. One of the ways they try to do it is they hire an army of prostitutes to try to seduce Ralph Nader, okay? And they want to try to get him in a compromised position so that they can ruin his integrity and his credibility before Congress. It doesn't work, okay? Ultimately, the chief CEO of GM is subpoenaed to testify before Congress, and he is grilled by Bobby Kennedy. And Bobby Kennedy is saying, is it true that y'all hired prostitutes, that y'all were trying to entrap this guy in compromising positions? They took the Fifth Amendment right there in front of the entire Congress. GM didn't want to answer the question, okay? Now, Nader ends up suing. He gets enough money from them to start Public Citizen. Many of y'all know that Ralph Nader, you know, became famous in 2000 for something completely unrelated to automobiles. And I know a lot of people are still a little hacked off at him. But this is a tipping point in terms of evolution of safety. This is when the momentum begins, is in the year 1965, with Ralph Nader and with Unsafe at Any Speed. We see in 1966 that the United States Congress mandates that cars that are made and sold in the United States have to have seat belts. Okay, go back on this. Look at your timeline. Look how long we've been having this discussion. Look how long it's been since the first American was killed by an automobile. And now look, in the year 1966 is the first time we're going to require that they sell them. By the way, just because you require that a car come with a seatbelt when you buy it does not mean that it was a crime to not wear your seatbelt. We're going to get to that in a little bit. 1966 is also the year the United States Department of Transportation is created. The Department of Transportation, that's the group that gets to inspect the quality and say, here's what a seatbelt has to be able to restrain in terms of physics. Here's what a motorcycle helmet must be able to withstand if there's a collision. I'm terrified when I hear stories about people buying motorcycle helmets at flea markets or on weekends. Look, that's crazy because unless it is DOT compliant, it does not have the ability to withstand the types of physics or sheer impact that can occur when people are involved in these motorcycle wrecks. Same is true with people who buy aftermarket seat belts and aftermarket other things. Okay, 1970, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is created. NHTSA, of course, provides a lot of money to states to do traffic safety training. They're subsidizing you being here today, okay? One of the reasons why y'all aren't paying more of a registration fee is because of the partnership that we have with TxDOT and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, so I thank them. 1974, the Mini Clubman Experimental Safety Vehicle is invented. This car is, this is something else y'all might not have never noticed about cars, but when people design cars, they have faces, and even car designers will tell you that every car has a face. They talk about the eyes of the car, the nose of the car, the mouth of the car, and if you think about, let me give you an example. 1956 Crown Victoria, 57 Chevy. Think about those cars. They all kind of had a bullet face, okay? Very flat and tall hood. Those cars were great at doing one of two things. When you hit a pedestrian, it either pulled them right into the manifold of the grill or it pulled them right under the car where they were crushed by the automobile. Those were the only two outcomes that were going to occur. No one ever ended up on the hood of those cars. They went through the car or under the car, and that was the only two ways to go. In 1974, Mini decides, wait a minute, couldn't we design a car so that there would be a greater chance that if a person were to be hit by a car, the pedestrian would end up not going under the car, but rather would come up onto the hood? Because believe it or not, you're better off ending up on the hood than you are going under the car. I bet you. 1975, National Traffic Safety Board is created. Now, you never want to hear about the NTSB, but when you hear about them on the news, what does the story have to do with? Come on, someone here can tell me. What's the NTSB associated with? Really? There you go. Thank you. Airplane crashes. The NTSB is sending an investigator anytime there is an airplane crash, a train wreck, a bus crash, anything that involves public transportation, fatalities or injuries or accidents. NTSB's involved, and that's what they do. This is a safety board that focuses on commercial transportation. All right. 1978, Volvo introduces its first booster seat. This is my son Liam. This is Iron Man. Okay. Now, funny thing about booster seats. All right. So here we go. 1978 is the year that the booster seats. We know that seat belts are not designed for people who are under 4 feet tall. We just know that, okay? Putting a kid who is 3.5 feet tall in a seatbelt is doing no favors to that kid, okay? Because you have to be there. When they design these belts, they're designed assuming a certain amount of height, okay? Now, this is the funny thing. 1978 is the year that they introduced the first booster seat. Let's see how many of y'all remember what year in Texas we required that we made it a criminal offense to not have your child in a child safety seat, or a booster seat as we refer to it as. What year was that? Yeah. What year? Yeah. Yeah. You're absolutely. In fact, I think you're dead on. Yeah. Try 2009, folks. Yeah. It was last session. That's the year we decided. Don't you remember that? What is it? They have to be at least, what is it? What's the age? 8 years old or 4 feet something? I can't remember that. But this is to show you the lag. This is how long it would take for us in Texas for us to get this. But once again, you understand this is one of our recurring themes when it comes to traffic safety. And the evolution of traffic safety is the lag, okay? From the time we recognize there's a problem, or from the time there's a good idea, to the time in which the good idea is accepted, or to the time in which the bad idea is criminalized, there's a lag. And people die in the interim, and people get hurt in the interim, while we still have all these good-spirited debates. Let me give you another example of how personally your experience in cars has changed. I clearly remember four, five, maybe 6 years old. I remember driving from Altus, Oklahoma. How many of y'all know where Altus, Oklahoma is? To my grandparents' home in El Dorado, Oklahoma. Anybody know where El Dorado, Oklahoma is? Okay. I clearly remember getting out of the front seat, crawling over the bench into the back seat, out of the back seat, and crawling into the rear windshield. Okay, laying in the rear windshield and staring up through the glass into the stars of heaven. Okay, now, how many of you have similar memories? That's my point. Okay, do you know what that would be described to as today? Child endangerment. I'm not even talking about getting a ticket. I'm saying that if you get pulled over by a 28-year-old state trooper and he finds that your child is lying in the rear windshield, you're getting cuffed and stuffed. You are going to be subject to a full custodial arrest. You are not going to get a warning. You're not going to get a ticket. You're going to end up getting, by the end of the evening, a body cavity search. You're going to jail is what is happening. That is the change in our standards. But y'all know this is true in another sense. How many of you remember a point in time in which, drunk driving just really wasn't that big of a deal? I mean, people used to drink and drive. They might get a fine. That was the end of it. Today, drinking and driving is the scarlet letter, okay? You do it, and there are not just legal consequences, it's not just financial consequences, there's a social stigma associated while driving while intoxicated, because a bunch of mothers decided that enough is enough, and we're not going to have any more people getting killed, especially our children getting killed, by people who are using alcohol in automobiles in an irresponsible manner. Now, by the same token, I'm going to tell you, when we do polls, we see that people who are young drivers, they don't have as much of a problem with texting while driving as people who are over the age of 55. They have a big problem with it. They have a big problem with it. I talked to someone just the other day. He said, texting and driving, hell, I can barely text while not driving. Because I can't imagine why anyone thinking that it would be an okay idea to try to text while driving. But you talk to some kid now who's been playing PlayStation 3 all day, who's IMing all day, who's always got a handheld electronic device in front of him, they wouldn't know what to do if they weren't driving down the road. What do you mean? I just have to watch the road? That's so boring. That's the mindset we're up against. But let me tell you where I anticipate things will go. I'm willing to bet you that those kids today who have that attitude, that their grandchildren will be shocked that it was ever okay to drive and text or use your cell phone, just the same way as my kid today can't believe that the car can operate if you're not wearing your seatbelt. My kid doesn't think that car moves wearing his seatbelt. In contrast, I almost have to put a gun to my mother's head to make her put on her seatbelt. Okay? That's the evolution of traffic safety, And just as y'all all remember a time when there was no stigma for drinking and driving, you watch. There will be a stigma someday for people who text and drive, use their cell phone and drive, and use their microchip implants in their brain improperly while driving. It's just an evolution issue. It's about history and time and social values and what we think is important. All right. It probably will. It probably will. And a lot of people are going to die in the interim. Okay, and a lot of people are going to get hurt, and it's going to be tragic. It's going to be truly tragic. 1979, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration begins crash testing popular cars. And they start putting this stuff actually on the sticker. And this is the first time in which people, when they go to buy a car, they don't just look at the features and the sticker price. They go, huh, is this a safe car? How does this car do in a crash test? Beginning in the 1980s is the first time we start seeing that the annual car issue of Consumer Reports sells more copies than your average issue of Motor Trend and, you know, and Car and Track. People aren't just thinking about how fast the cars go. Now they want to know, are they good? Are they reliable? How long do they last? And a lot of you have looked to the Consumers Union and Consumers Reports when you make those decisions about buying your family's cars. Those were ideas that were absolutely foreign to your grandparents. They would have never thought about reading a consumer magazine, you know, before you went, how does the car look? How much does it cost? That was it. Okay? 1984. I can't believe this. 1984. The year that Bruce Springsteen releases Born in the USA and Madonna and Prince are huge. This is the year that the first state makes it a criminal offense to not wear a seatbelt. Okay, go back again. What year did the government start requiring that seatbelts be put in cars? I think that was 1966, okay? So go ahead. So it took 18 years after that the equipment was mandatory in the car that the first state would require that you use your seatbelt, okay? Now, the kicker is, every state falls in line except one, okay? And the only state that right now as we speak that does not have a seatbelt law is New Hampshire. But that makes sense because their state motto is live free or die. It ought to be live free and die when it comes to not wearing your seatbelt. 1986, government requires that you have a third brake light installed. It becomes mandatory equipment that you have a third brake light installed in these automobiles. If you're really lucky, you could get a Batman brake light installed in your car. 1989, government says that passive automobile restraints have to be put in cars. Now, this passive restraint is something more than just the lap belt. And the car makers balk, and they don't really want to do it, and airbags are too expensive, and no one's going to want to buy it. No one wants airbags. And so Congress gives them a choice. You can either have an airbag on the driver's side, or you could have this now infamously crappy contraption known as the automated seatbelt. Do y'all remember these things? These things were classic pieces of junk, okay? These were things like, I remember we had these in our driver's ed cars in Vernon, Texas. You'd get in the car like, and get back in there, turn on the car, and this thing would come back up. And they were really bad because, one, you still had to put on your lap belt, and cops couldn't tell if you were wearing your lap belt because it was out of their point of view. And people thought they were really just like, look at me, I'm breaking the law. Of course, what you were really doing is about to break your neck as you get clotheslined on that damn thing that's going across you. And so we figured out, I have a friend who's a salvage, he sells used cars for scrap and salvage. He says that even in the world of used up cars, that no one wants these things. Because half the time the seat belts are missing. He said, and also, if y'all haven't figured this out, this is an absolute great place to hit your head, is on this connector point on this motorized track. All right. So you know who won the battle between the airbag and the automated seatbelt. It would have been the airbag. 1998, dual airbags become required standard equipment. If you have purchased a new car since 1998, all cars have dual airbags. Today we're in the third generation of airbags. These airbags actually weigh how much the passengers weigh. They decide how strong the explosive is going to be based off of the weight of the passenger. We still see people who get airbag dermatitis, but not the types of injuries that we used to see in first and second generation airbags. The only bad thing about airbags now is they're expensive to replace once they detonate. Okay, once they go off, they're expensive to replace. 1995, the IIHS begins doing offset crash tests. No longer, they're going to start saying, what happens if you hit at different angles? What happens? Oh, this is a picture of a 2009 Mercedes C300 doing a head-on with a 2009 Smart for two. Don't know about you, but this doesn't look too smart if you're in the smart car to me. Here's another angle. When they start doing, in 2003, they start doing side impact crash tests. Okay, and in the side impact crash test, well, it's not very good for the smart car. Check this out. I can't tell if this is actually a smart car or something you would see sitting out on your neighbor's curb on oversized garbage haul-away day. But this is a smart car that's been involved in a car wreck. 2004, National Highway Traffic Safety Administration releases new test data about rollover risks in SUVs. Now, I want to talk to y'all for a second about this because this is a really big deal. There is new data, and I say new data like I mean this week, in which we're starting to see for the very first time that some of these stability control things that are being put in automobiles are starting to make some SUVs safer than cars. But it's the very first time we've seen this data. Let me tell you what we've seen. What we've seen, particularly here in Texas from 2004 all the way up to the present time, is people who drive SUVs have a phony, false sense of security, okay? They have a phony, false sense of security. An SUV has a higher sense of balance. It's actually easier to roll over. And particularly in young drivers, remember, during the first 500 hours that a young person is driving, they are more likely to kill themselves or kill someone else, to injure themselves or permanently injure someone else. We call it the golden 500 hours. That's the reason why we have these graduated driver's license privileges. It's the reason why they can't have more than one person in the car. It's the reason why they can't be driving after a certain hour. It's the reason why they can't be texting or using their cell phone while driving. We know that that first 500 hours is a critical period of time. A lot of Texans have made an unfortunate mistake of judgment. They think that their precious daughters and sons would be safer in the family Suburban or the family Yukon or the family Excursion or what have you than they would be in, let's say, Dad's Toyota Camry. Okay, and that's wrong. Because what we see is that there are more adolescents, all those things, and it has to do with this center of balance. Now, maybe this data is going to start changing as we start seeing stability control become norm and older vehicles are off the road. But for right now, this is what you need to know, especially if you have young drivers in your house. They are not safer in your SUVs than in your family Suburbans, okay? And, you know, that's something that TxDOT actually has been hammering home. Y'all might remember they even started a campaign that they were trying to target young drivers, in which they described driving an SUV or a pickup truck as being akin to riding a bull at a rodeo. And they said that, you know, you've got to fasten yourself in when you're riding the bull. And the bull is the SUV. And on this ad, they've got this automated bull that's actually, you can't tell if it's a bull or a Jeep. And because it's computerized. But that's how they're trying to hit that point home. So I found it funny that when they did the study, that the safest car, in terms of if you don't want to roll over, the safest car is the Mazda RX-8. And I think it's really funny because this is in Family Car. This picture was taken from familycar.com. And the last time I checked, unless your family is a family of Smurfs, I cannot imagine having the Mazda RX-8 as your choice of family car. Okay, oh my goodness. Now, my wife is small and my children are still small, but there's hope for my children because they're still growing. Okay? I think that's kind of funny that this was chosen to be the car with the best rollover. Your lowest chance of rolling over would be in a Mazda RX-8. All right. Okay. Which begs the real question, are we any safer? Okay? And that's kind of where I'm going to bring this thing and I'm going to land at the mothership here. That's where we're going to come to port and put the proverbial gear in park. Because all this thing has happened. You know, we see, you know, we've gone through this period where car makers, they fought this idea, finally they've accepted this idea, and we've seen that our cars have gotten safer. By the way, quick story about this picture here. For those of you who have ever been to our office, this is actually, this is Lamar, and this is where you turn on to Shoal Creek, and this is actually the turn into our office. This picture was taken on the first day that Katie Teff came to work at TMCEC. And I can only imagine what she thought as she turned into our office building and saw this caution zombies ahead sign. And so here's the big kicker. While our cars are safer, we are not. And it brings me to this notion of risk compensation. Now, if you have tuned out, tuned back in, I'm almost done. This is the big dismount. Risk compensation is this, it's a social phenomenon that's been studied, and this is what we know. If people perceive themselves as being safer, they engage in more behaviors that put them at risk. As people perceive themselves as being in danger, they tend to engage in behaviors that keep them safer. Okay? Do you see the paradox here? So this is what's happened. As cars have gotten safer, people have not. People think that, hey, I've got 6 airbags and anti-lock brakes, and I've got all these great engineering devices to keep me safer in my car. I guess it's okay for me to put on my eye makeup and use my iPod, okay? In contrast, if you have a a kid who's driving a vehicle and you tell them, look, I'm not going to tell you when it's going to happen. Or not a kid, anybody, any of you in this room. If I told you, listen, I'm not going to tell you when it's going to happen, but I promise you, while you're driving home from this conference, you're going to have a blowout and you're going to lose control of your car. I promise you it's going to happen, but I'm not going to tell you when. Studies show that you will drive that car in a way you're going to be on guard the whole time, waiting for the event. And you're going to be safer, okay? So that's the paradox. When you think you're safer, you tend to engage in less safe behaviors. When you think you're in danger, you tend to engage in more safe behavior, which is what you're up against. So, yes, cars have gotten safer, but the human condition remains what it has always been. People making bad decisions. People making risky decisions. And this should not surprise you, this next chart. Here are the safety trends we see comparing three, four industrialized nations, even adjusting, even when you take into consideration the number of the population of the United States is much greater, you can see that that the blue is 1979 fatalities, and you see that the red is 2002 fatalities. You still see that the United States leads Great Britain, Canada, and Australia in the number of people who are involved in traffic fatalities. And it's one of those things that while I think that we're making a lot of progress, and we've seen a lot of positive data recently, we also know, okay, drunk driving, down, okay, people using seatbelts, up, okay, but then we had this whole thing about distracted driving. This whole thing, the chemistry between cell phone and the driver who is driving an automobile is just at the cusp, or just at the beginning of having this discussion, just like we did, about consuming alcohol and driving. Because, y'all probably seen this and heard it said by other speakers. When people are driving and they are distracted, it is akin to driving while sleepy. It is akin to driving while intoxicated. It does affect their performance behind the wheel. So we definitely have our work cut out for you, cut out for us collectively. And I hope that all this has been beneficial to you because, like I said, we have these relationships with these cars, and we see people who come to our courts because of their cars, but we really don't have that many opportunities to stop, have a time out on the field, and kind of just think about how we got to where we are. And that's kind of the purpose of why we've had this discussion today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Thank you very much. I want to encourage you. How many of you are on Facebook? Are y'all on Facebook? I encourage you all to like TMCEC on Facebook. We are averaging one new follower a day. We're increasingly going to be using Facebook and Twitter to put out news about the center and about events from the center. So if you have not already decided to like us, to really like us, just like Sally Field said at the Academy Awards, I want to encourage you to do so. All right, thank you very much. I'll talk to you later.